This is a very cool toy.
We're recording.
Hello, Beth.
Hello. Stay away from the mic.
How do you do?
Are you podcasting us?
Not exactly.
Yes?
But yes.
Are you going to podcast us?
That's what I've been doing. This is an MP3 recorder.
So this is, oh, this is the Anu iRiver.
Yeah, I was using
I like it.
A Sony mini disc, but then it takes like real time, whatever you record real time, it takes to load it.
To do this.
Digitize it.
This is much better because David is trying to get us all to use something called Audacity, which is an open source recording tool. But this has the advantage of reportability, which
mm-hmm.
is nice, although you could probably use
but
this.
But you would want to use that if you took a file from here.
So you could then use Audacity.
This is just a hard drive.
An MP3.
So
right.
USB to your machine. Then you can load it into Audacity, which is an open source editing software.
Well, this is great because I'm starting a new podcast.
Set.
I'm going to do a podcast called Democracy Stories. I want to do stories. I want to talk to people who are using technology in interesting and democratic and civic ways. Speaking of which, I have regards for you from Clippinger, whom I just had lunch with. Oops.
Thank you.
You needed me to tell you that, I'm sure. You had to both come to New York to meet with. We got to chatting.
Well, Rick was just asking me what brought me here, and I was telling him that I'd just come from a conference at the Museum of Television and Radio, DRM, and it was really wonderful, fascinating.
Was it sort of broadcast flag?
No,
focused?
No, definitely beyond the broadcast flag. The focus was, first of all, a demonstration. Excellent. By a chief technology officer from Warner Bros. Of technology that he just brought in from a consumer electronics show, which makes it so simple and fluid to record an analog image to digital. That this served as a predicate for showing this audience the gaping digital,
the analog hole.
Right, that's what they were talking.
Hooray
about.
For the analog hole! But he shouldn't show this to people, or they'll try to fix the analog hole.
Oh, they're trying to desperately fix it. He doesn't even. He's a professional guy trying to fix it. That's he's just trying to bring them to terms with how tough it really is.
I had a very interesting, actually, teaching experience yesterday, or just sort of, I mean, this is sort of an obvious point, but, you know, I teach this class on high-tech copyright called Innovation Copyright in the Internet. I forgot what it's called.
This year.
This one, the name hasn't changed. That's the e-democracy course. I keep changing the name. But, you know, the students, I try to sort of bring, you know, they come from such a kind of conservative perspective, and when we talk about something like television, you know, we talk about the broadcast flag, they sort of say, well, what's the big deal? Why should we be allowed to, you know, we don't need to have the right to copy shows, or we don't need to have the right to manipulate things. They don't understand this. And then yesterday we had a presentation by Paul Marino. We looked at Machinima, which is filmmaking from video games. And because the technology is new and it hasn't been something that's been typically regulated before, and it's a whole new art form, and they play video games, this was so obvious to them as something they should be able to do. Well, of course you should be able to output from your video game to make a movie, so you can cut and splice it and take the characters and make scenes and do animation. But of course, this was, and I said, yeah, well, how is this different from everything else we've looked at? And it just is like this cultural divide between sort of traditional media
mm-hmm.
and the rhetoric that they get and the, you know, what they're hearing.
Oh,
and then what they're, and on the video games, there's, oh, well, yes, of course you have to be able to play with it and cut it, and it's your, you know, constitutional right to do so, but not television and not music, not, you know, their conception of culture is so funny. But anyway, so
Beth, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Rick will say much more flattering things than I will. I should leave.
Well, just a footnote.
Your footnote. I should. You know, I should have not come. I should have not come down.
I know I've met you. I met you
at the
summer camp.
What is summer camp? Is that
just passing? I didn't.
Well, you left early this year. I came this year, not the year before.
Yeah.
And I talked much more to Fern. Actually, we had a nice. We talked. Fern on the other side of the boat. No, and so I was, yeah, and when I actually presented, you were gone by that point, so we didn't really have much of a chance to talk. So here we are.
That's just a lawyer.
Just a lawyer. Just a lawyer. So what are we doing here? What do I do? Who am I? Oh my God!
I'll start.
All right, you start, and then I know the answer to this.
Beth is that unusual combination of faculty member that's lived in lots of worlds at one time. So there's a very rigorous intellectual that's got all the blue chip credentials that all of us like to look at. You know, get your PhD, go to your Yale and Harvard, go off and do some foreign study. You know, all that good stuff, and it bundles up into someone who can go practice law and you know, write the things that lawyers do. But then there's this other part that said, you know, I think I'd like to develop software and create product and form my own company and try to push the envelope of the way people do meetings and decision making. And gee, wouldn't it be great if I could do that in a way that would be for benefiting all of us through democracy reform. So there's two things over here that don't seem to be well connected end up finding their way to academia through an interesting packaging of what your intellectual interests are, and then, you know, finding a way to bridge what we have to do in order to get tenure and all the things that you're required to do in the academic world, but combining it up with all of the things that make it fun to be part of an institution defining itself a little bit differently, and connecting up people who otherwise don't play with us in a kind of an environment that allows creativity and more fun. I mean, that's, I think, what we're really doing is having lots of fun.
We're having fun. Well, that's the thing we have in common also with what you guys are doing. And I guess what sort of would, to fill in a hole somewhere in between is when I was an undergrad, I took Anthony Ettinger's tech policy class and was going to go off at that point to work on a thesis on democratization and technology in China. I was interested in, you know, how culture brings about democracy, a small topic, hampered only by the fact that I didn't know Chinese very well at that point, and still don't. Went off instead to look at democratization and culture in Vienna and spent some time in coffee houses.
What year was this?
Oh, that was 92. And then, so...
So what knocked you off China?
Language. But I mean, that the project to do it right would be, at that point, was language. I'd had a little bit of Chinese and not enough at that point. And actually, the very first place I met you was the very, very first Berkman Center event, which was about China. I think that was the first event was on, what was it called, Digital China or something
like
that?
Digital Harvard China.
Digital Harvard China, the very first event. And so anyway, became interested in a whole set of issues about how technology, be it sort of what I was looking at was the paperback novel in 1920s Vienna, or the new technologies later, aided the process of democratization, and all of the issues around people doing things for themselves, classical notions, democratic theory notions about self-governance. I came from a background in democratic theory, and combined this then ended up being the first time Larry taught cyber law. I was in that class, the class that became the Code as Law book. So you combine that with the notion that, you know, after 1 year in law school, you can become an instant expert in something known as, you know, cyber law was completely new at that point. And so I was consulting by my second year of law school, and it was just tremendously fun to put these issues together. And then somehow began very, I don't know what it came from exactly, you know, I don't know what the psychology of it is, but very quickly got into the notion of actually designing code as a way to sort of change the world. And it was probably, you know, the lessons that Larry taught, but I actually wanted to do the tinkering, which is the fun part. And so we built, one of the first projects we did was that very controversial filtering design project that the Bertelsmann Foundation sponsored. That was about 96 or 97. And Jack Balkin and I put together the framework for the standard that sort of was supposed to replace RSAC and become the new ICRA. But we sort of did the kind of concept of what would the software look like that would both protect free speech and enable you to do effective filtering. And that was the first kind of concept design phase. And then the next project the next year was UnChat.
And Jack was really into that?
Jack was dragged kicking and screaming into doing that. I mean, I was the first fellow of the Information Society Project, so I was the John Zittrain of Yale, I guess, which is how I ended up getting invited to the first Berkman Center thing, was I sat on Jack's sofa for 3 years, and that became the Information Society project.
This wasn't a plug abuse situation.
Sorry.
And that's what I do. That's what you do now.
No, that's right.
That's my current job. Employment abuse? How does one answer this? Like, it's always, no, this was student abuse. No, but I didn't want to be employment abuse, so I.
But you had ways around Jack, though. That's one of the nice things.
Well, that was actually the first way we got into Bill. That's true. This is so fun. I'm recounting. This is much more. You wanted a short answer to the question. I'm giving you my life saga here. But anyway, I don't know how he got. I just came and said, well, I want to do this project, and you have to do this with me. And yeah, and then he took a lot of heat for this one because it was very controversial. Anyway, the next big project, and that's the hens at the end of the saga, is I hooked up with a friend of mine who's a political philosopher by the name of Ben Barber, and we created a tool called UnChat in about 98, and it was the first tool, and it still is the only thing that does this, for synchronous group conversation that lets the group choose the rules for the conversation, implement the rules through the software, and change the rules. So it's self-moderated chat. And it's the only thing that really lets you do, sort of have 30 people together in a room and run a structured conversation, but in a kind of self-organizing, emergent way. And once you get bitten with the bug of building things, as you know, it becomes fun to tinker. And Rick was the only, you know, I mean, it would be... I don't want to say it, but Rick was crazy enough to think that this was somehow a qualification to make me a law professor. So as I always say, I tried to sell New York Law School UnChat, and they wanted the user's manual instead of just the software. So they took the software with the user's manual, and that's me. And we set about, set up something here called the Democracy Design Workshop, with the idea being that we would focus on innovations for civic and so-called democratic purposes, but not democratic in the purely, not in the Washington sense of democratic, but in the self-ordering emergent sense of democratic, and that we would set about building stuff and making things. That's what we do. Cool. We make stuff. All right. That was cool. A short story made long in answer to your question. And that's why David Johnson is here, because he naturally gravitated to, you know, David's a tinkerer, and so he's come to play in the sandbox. And David Post is coming in the fall to play in the sandbox. And other people are playing in the sandbox. And we run something called The Conspiracy, which John may have told you about, which is basically every other week we have we have drinks. These days we meet at Google, thanks to Andrew McLaughlin. It's part of the gang. And we basically do social software design together, collaborative social software design. So it's show and tell for grown-ups. Someone, you have to show something to come and show an idea, and then everybody talks about the idea and refines it, and we design together. And it's the software, I mean, you don't have to have a fully fledged prototype, it can be a doodle, but you have to have an idea for something you want to build that's a kind of social or visual technology. And so it leads to sort of like-minded, interested people coming out of the woodwork.
Sounds wonderful. Sounds like I'd like to attend.
You would like to attend. You would like to attend. I'm going to add you to my list.
And what's nice is we're using that thought process to go into bring the kids here into the same kind of work before they graduate. Law schools talk about, you know, the final project or the capstone project, and I think one of the nice modeling exercises we're going in is forcing some of our students to design something before they leave.
And, so tell me about you, Rick.
Well, you know, I'm pretty traditional as academics go. You know, law school, clerkship, the whole range that does all that stuff. I practice for a bit, but I come to education with a sort of a sideways slant. I just don't think what we do makes any sense anymore. And the places I've been, we've all kind of tried to come at legal education by saying, what's the better way to do it? Why are we doing what we're doing? What are the needs of the students? Why are we educating them? Where are they going to? So we bring much more of, I don't want to use the word commercial too loosely, but more of a commercial thought process into why we're doing education. And there's a point at which, when your education cost goes from $4,000 a year to $40,000 a year, that you better make the transition into thinking about why people are making that kind of investment. So the schools that I've been part of, you know, I was dean of Chicago, Catnet, Florida, and here, each one of the schools, we've asked the question about redesigning what we're doing to be more sensitive to the end result that the students are trying to seek and the end results we're trying to seek. I mean, so, you know, it's a negotiation. We all have a theory about why we want to do this. We all are engaged in our research and our thinking because we have a set of goals, and it would be very, it would be much more sensible if we could take our goals and the students' goals and somehow connect them, as opposed to having one law school for the faculty and another law school for the students, and, you know, the twain only meet because there's a brand name they've bought at the end that they want to use for some end purpose.
You're preaching to the choir.
Well, I know. I mean, I obviously I'm familiar with where you're coming from, but it's made a big difference in the way that for me, I've evolved into going to places that are less restrictive as opposed to more restrictive. And we don't have a university. It's the perfect environment for tinkerers of all kinds. Yeah. And this is a very action-oriented institution. You know, down from somebody like Nadine Strassen, who's our ACLU Prez faculty member, who wants to accomplish sets of things, down to, you know, each of us who in one way or another are fairly driven to see outcomes. And we've reoriented the education by giving the students some real significant customization options. The ideal world for us in our strategic planning is to say, right program for each student, and literally mean that at 1,500 people here, that they can walk in the door and they may have a common language exercise in the first year so we can kind of get on the same page, but treating the upper level of law school as the chance to either explore what you care about or for us to help you find what you care about and then get you to explore it. And, you know, cycle time is the next big issue for us. Can we get the kids out of here sooner or with less requirement to delay their entry into adulthood, and can we drive it backward, get kids younger? There's just a whole series of questions about the box that legal education is that I think we want to push and tinker with and play with. So distance education for us is not a revenue tool. That's a nice thing to have revenue, but we're really trying to figure out, is there a way for us to be more efficient, more effective in linking people who belong together even if they're not at the same school? Can we build a different kind of community in our teaching? And that's a really tough question. I mean, I know you've been thinking about that also, and that for us trying to imagine the 50 people around the country who belong either as part of our faculty or part of our student body on any given project, and seeing them as each one a separate individual opportunity for that collaboration is, I think, what drew me to the projects that Beth and David are working on. And they've well described the top line philosophy as one about groups and group decision making and group behavior, and that's probably really what where all of us are thinking about, which is this undefined group that we're a part of, and the desire that most of our students have to connect up on things that are not easily identifiable. It's not race or gender or height or basketball affiliation or the usual. It's some other set of less identifiable interests.
How do you connect it to law?
Well, I don't know if it doesn't matter, at least in part, in connecting it to law. I mean, because I think law is so ubiquitous that we'll find the touch point that happens with law is something that will happen to us as we're working through organically to figure out those sets of interest. So, I mean, the first place is, you know, that's what we're good at, so we'll start at the things we're good at. I know Beth is a con law, administrative law, intellectual property person. Well, that's, you know, that's part of your conversation is going to be walking through those things, and it allows us to connect up. But we've got another guy in our faculty that's all about mental health. And if mental health is the lens, we're going to draw people who are only marginally interested in the law part of it, but really interested in the management of mental health industries or otherwise. And you know, I like law has a nice connector capability to it, and what we sometimes call about the glue function for a lot of other things that have to be there. And I don't mind being the connecting point for lots of other disciplines. You know, it's that concept that when we talk about the university and this multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary or some connectivity disciplinarity, I've never been in a university that worked. I mean, University of Iowa, where I taught most of my teaching career, or IIT, you know, a technical university, or University of Florida, it was, you know, it was not functioning well to bring the multiple disciplines together, because we had interferences like who got the money and you know, and who got the credit. And I think it's much more open textured for us now to have people who are interested in a concept.
What's the name of the law school at the University of Florida?
The Fred Levin College of Law.
You were dean of that?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, Fred's my buddy.
Fred's my buddy too.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's just a wonderful guy. And I came in with his law firms.
That was a remarkable connection.
Yeah, it's you haven't met Fred, but you would really like him. Just there was a part of his gift to us that was more fun than anything I've ever done, which is the part where he just said, "What's the thing that I could do that would piss off the most people in the state of Florida?" He said, "To take their university and put a Jewish guy's name on it." It was a fun thing.
And, is that true? Oh,
yeah, it is true actually.
Did he piss him off?
Yeah.
Oh God, they're still pissed. They brought 3 bar infringement actions against him.
Oh, well, that part
total
of the
crud.
Well, the best was he had a little TV show and talking about gambling. You know, gambling is illegal, Beth. I don't know if you knew this, but Beth said, you know, Fred said, you know, football game without a wager, just not that much fun. So, you know, I put some money on all those games. And they went after him as sort of advocating illegal activity.
Well, this is the feelings about it. I love his response, though, at least as I heard it. It's, hey, look, you want the name? I'll put it up for sale. Just give me my money back out. That's fine.
Well, it was as
nobody takes him up on it.
Well, even better. I mean, one of our students put it up on eBay. And no bids came in. It just said law school for sale.
Oh, that part I didn't know.
Well, there's a wonderful Florida story. The law school had wooden floors for most of its history. These, you know, beautiful oaken floors. And the tradition among the relatively redneck population that was attending the law school in that era was, when they were displeased with something, to shuffle their feet along the ground. And it made quite an appallingly loud and ugly noise. So the tradition of shuffling was used most effectively against women. Okay, don't like women, bad thing. And the first African Americans that attended the school, it was the tradition of shuffling when each of them walked in the room or spoke in class or whatever else. Well, Fred came to Florida the year that the law school was desegregated, and actually made friends with the one African-American kid who was there, who was just brutalized while he was in school. And Fred was not well-treated either. He was driving a Cadillac at the time, you know, wore all black in Florida, which was not a good thing. And, you know, just didn't look like anyone else around the place. And so he was not well-treated, and he ended up being, you know, one or two in the class before he graduated. So I went off to talk after this gift, and I did my penance. I went out all over the state to take people, you know, let them yell and scream at me. So I went to see this one lawyer in Orlando, very famous defendant's trial lawyer, who you know, said, "Dean, I got to tell you what's going on here." I said, "Tell me this. You don't understand the politics of this thing at all, do you?" I said, "Well, I understand some." He said, "No, you really don't." He said, "When Fred was in law school, he was shuffled, and we're shuffling him now, too." And it stuck with me as, you know, very much a red state, blue state problem, although that wasn't the language you would have used when it was all happening. Because Florida is at least 3 states and probably 4 states, and most of them are not places where I would want to live. That was part of the politics of what was going on. It was just simply a not the right kind of person problem. But what's so funny about it is, you know, this is now 5 years, and that's the lexicon. The place has changed.
So, okay, now you're dean of New York.
We are.
Law School. And I assume you've got some backer.
We
have some backer. And it's yours. This is your enterprise.
But if you have any others you'd like to send away, I'm sure... He's a dean, he'll always take them.
There are I believe it is, I still fiduciary responsibilities at Florida, is the way I look at my role back there. Fred is a Florida person, and so he and I speak every now and then, but it's not for me to bring him here, or in that case. So we're going to, we are New York, we'll find our own Freds here, and there are many of them that we can have. And
Fred spoke in my class.
Did he?
He went to his class.
He's a fantastic lawyer.
We could spend the night together, loving stories.
Yeah, I mean, he owns the TV station in town. He owned all this real estate along the Gulf. And what's sort of funny is, he quietly supporting Morris D's, doing enormous amounts of good pro bono over the Florida. I don't know if you ever heard the Florida tobacco litigation stories.
I've heard a bunch of them.
Yeah, they're just fantastic. I mean, I knew all the lawyers.
Fred opened with my class sometimes he said the best law I've ever practiced. Took me 20 minutes.
Eliminating the immunities in Florida for the tobacco companies through a piece of legislation.
Just here it is, yeah. Love Child's book, and the industry gets hit with losses that absolutely did not see coming.
And the beauty of it, Fred never was part of the litigation. He just assembled the team and had his share written into their agreement at the top end. But the best, the best part, did you know Charles? Or ever meet Charles?
No.
What a guy. I mean, Lawton was an incredibly interesting guy. Buddy McKay, his deputy, what do they call him? Vice governor, what the hell's the word? Deputy governor, right. The guy who represented the state of Florida on the Democratic side during the last election. These are old line Florida guys who knew every county, every clerk, and you wanted something done, you had 3 phone calls, and that's how everything got done. And Fred was the guy who connected that up.
So, say something more about Shaw.
Well,
I'm just trying to identify, what's the state of mind that shuffles.
In Florida, the traditions of the state of Florida are that the north part of the state, which is truly the deep south, ran the state through almost its entire history. The corridor that takes you from Jacksonville to Pensacola is along I-10, and the state never was any further south than that until air conditioning. So it was built through these folks who were South Georgia, South Mississippi folk, and they were the last state to desegregate in the country. Not a well-known fact for most of us from the North, but they disobeyed a direct mandate of the Supreme Court to desegregate the University of Florida. And this group of people, deeply populist, and deeply Baptist, control the political apparatus up until very recently. And what's happened is, as with most of the country, that same group have found their way from the old line Democratic Party to the new line Republican Party, and found great allies in the Cuban exile community in the South. So they forged a very interesting set of alliances. The state is highly decentralized in its local politics, so that the Hispanic community has its own sort of internal governing structure. The middle part of the state are these technocratic sort of Disney-esque people who are almost entirely interested only in industry. And then the northern part remains very much its traditional state.
And it's still shuffle. What's the state of mind? You're going to shuffle the black guy that comes in. You're going to shuffle.
It's a southern way of being impolite while smiling at you. There's a gentility to the whole, it would never be a conversation where we'd sit at a table like this and one would say to the other one, you no good SOB. It would never be a conversation where if you said something, the person on the other side of the table would say to you, you're full of crap. It's much more a subtle, a wink, when we leave, Beth goes to her buddies and says, you can't believe what I just went through. And that...
You're about to say that.
Well, I hope so. So that portion of the mentality remains.
But is it at core racist? Is that the idea?
You know.
I mean, when you get down to the line, it's subtle and it's this and it's that, but still, there's something that triggers when you shuffle and when you don't.
Well, those traditions, the racial traditions of the South, haven't died easily. And I think that some of it is racial, but you know, and it's also religious. I remember in starting, I got a call my first day as dean from one of the board of trustee members. You know, actually a really interesting guy who I got to know over the years. But you know, hi, welcome to the University of Florida. Good to see you, Dean. You're a wonderful guy. You know, where are you from? I said, from Chicago. No. Where are you from originally? Chicago. How about your kinfolk? So they're from, well, my dad was from Indiana and my mom was from No, in the old country, Romania. You a good Catholic boy? I said, no. Yeah. That was, in the first 2 days at work, evidence of a need to situate people into their stereotype. And, you know, I was almost certainly identified as a New Yorker in most cases, though I never lived in New York, you know, and I only went to school on the East Coast, but, you know, and I would say almost anyone here would think I'm from some laconic place like the Midwest. And so it was just very interesting.
Yeah, we think better of you than that.
So Midwest is a great place. Solid virtues.
All right, so the purpose of my visit.
Yeah.
Let me turn it around the other way. What could I do for you? What could you imagine the Burton Center doing for you?
That's a very good question. Beth, you want to say something? I mean, I know you've thought a lot about the Burton Center. I want to tell you about other things I've thought about, and then maybe it connects or it doesn't. I have a dream speech runs something like this. I have a dream that kindred spirits at a half a dozen law schools get together and form a national law school. They do it in a way that breaks hierarchy, breaks boundaries, but is about really high quality, smart people who have something worth saying, and they share. And they figure out a way to do it where we can get the access to information into people's hands, and we find like-minded people who are willing to take our best assets, let them star in some sense by providing some core material, and then locally we work with that core material in ways that are really interesting. So that might amount to branding a whole new thing that's never been heard of before, our own law school, you know, the National Legal Institute, and it's all about taking the best of all of our partnerships and turning them into a group of students that are quite different than other students, who educate themselves differently, who see themselves as collaborators. And there's a day that will come that that's going to happen. I used to say it's the day that Harvard woke up one day and said, gee, everyone could be our law school. Now let's go buy, you know, through branding, through otherwise, bunches of places that we think are terrific. We'll give them a Harvard Gold Star and they'll be part of our orbit, and we'll conquer the world. Well, you know, luckily that's not going to happen because there's lots of things that stand in the way of that happening at Harvard. But there will maybe it's NYU. John might have done it had John stayed as the dean at the law school, and then or as president could order people what to do, because we've talked a lot about that at NYU. But they're not going to do it either. So maybe it happens organically with lots of upstarts who get together and have no other way of competing. But to me, that's where a Berkman that hangs out at New York Law School, along with the Yale group hang out at New York Law School, defies any logic, right? I mean, people, why is this collaboration taking place? It doesn't make sense in some hierarchical sense. So you have to construct a new story for it that allows it to make sense. And that new story is the one we write. So that's, in my mind, something that we can do. I just don't know how you make that happen yet.
Well, let me I think I know how, I mean, I know how, I mean, there's the larger vision about the law school without walls and boundaries.
Yes,
and
we have smaller.
And it frankly might not even be a law school.
Point of order.
We are in the dean's office.
Yes.
Of the New York Law School.
We are.
Indeed.
It's a place of amenity. Is there anything to drink?
Yeah, well, not much. You want a Diet Coke?
He's very...
Diet Coke will work great.
Diet Coke we can do. And candy. Just
Diet Coke. That's perfect.
He's not. I was actually thinking when you walked in here that I'm going to buy him a coffee maker. I mean, he can afford one, but I don't know why he doesn't have one. Because he doesn't drink coffee. He only drinks Diet Coke. How come you don't have a coffee maker?
I don't know. Well, I don't drink coffee, so that's probably why.
I mean, I just said it.
But we can usually get coffee quickly.
Coffee happens, I suppose. Well, I have a dear friend who's a professor at the University of St. Gallen. He has the office I aspire to. He has an office, and then he has a coffee house next to his office. He has a table, chairs, espresso machine. It's a whole little setup designed to look like a Viennese coffee house. It's quite pleasant. And he meets people there.
We can play basketball.
Yes, you can play. You could have offered Charlie to play basketball, I suppose. So I think what the sort of smaller scale or the way to, I mean, where I sort of see something like this going forward. I mean, I was very excited as John and I, in some sense, and Clippinger and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, we're already doing this. I mean, we talk to each other and we collaborate with each other and we have fun together because there is a sort of self-identified group of fun people who work on issues of law and technology. And I think the people who work in the area of law and technology are a special, it's my bias now, but it's a special brand of person who is really, it's a kind of different track to the Constitution. We're sort of like our own version of constitutional law in the sense that what people share in common is not, it's not simply the toys, but it's really an interest in the bigger, larger vision questions about, you know, social order and how it happens and kind of law in its broadest sense, and are interested only in technology insofar as it holds up a mirror to the way society is changing. And these are people who like to engage in often very, you know, not people who are wedded to talking about doctrine, who know doctrine but, you know, aren't confined or constrained by it, and who are fun and want to play together. And also there are a lot of fun people who do this stuff. And so we've already started a lot of these conversations, and my view is where this can, and yet each of the institutions that sort of would be, that sort of come to mind have different strengths. So if you look at what, you know, there are the institutions, I mean, Berkman does really everything well, but you have the institutions that are more about kind of doing amicus brief writing. So I think, you know, Pam's group, they focus primarily on writing briefs in important cases. And Larry's stuff, I mean, they're doing also things in the tinkering. They're kind of left coast tinkerers, and then doing some of the amicus brief stuff. But their left coast tinkering is not, I mean, they have one, I mean, they have the kind of IP-based things like working now on the, having sort of Creative Commons having migrated to the left coast, and the open law stuff, and now the free software side of things. So they're entirely focused on kind of open source from the back end. We're much more interested in open source from the front end, in the sense of how do we create software for people to collaborate and work together, because the big underlying theme for what we do is a belief in the power of collective action and law in the sense of people engaging in self-governance. So I'm a big fan of open source in terms of the code, but I'm really interested in open, collaborative, peer-to-peer mechanisms for doing things, and engaging in much more rapid prototyping of innovations as a way to get them out there. And so there's this wonderful kind of synergy of things that are going on. So if you ask me, though, what you could do for us and what we could do together is I really want us to establish what we're already both doing in terms of the innovations that we're building, whether it's H2O or UNCHAD or the kinds of innovations that are coming out of the conspiracy here. What we want to do is to create the infrastructure to get these innovations out in the world, to build them and get them out faster,
and to create a lot of hoopla around the design of civic and social software. And one of the ideas that I know we've both heard from John, that we're both working on the same thing, is to try to develop a pipeline for taking some of these ideas to market as a way to generate revenue for doing more innovation internally within the law school, and also as a way to attract innovators and, you know, entrepreneurial people who don't have access to and don't want to have access to the venture capital markets. They don't want to go start making PowerPoints and jumping through hoops, but they want maybe a way to develop their ideas so they can keep, you know, earn a little money so they can keep doing them. And this is an idea we already started to talk about at Yale a couple of years ago. Do you know Carol Stevens at Yale? Or was at Yale? He was the associate dean at Yale for 17 years and left, in large part because at an institution like Yale, which is what we don't have the problem with here, there wasn't a way to do this kind of thing. We talked about creating a kind of, what's it called, social venture capitalism, social philanthropy group. They would have rights of first refusal on technology and innovation coming out of a law school. And people were looking at us like, innovation out of a law school? What are you talking? I mean, we have like biotech we get and the engineering department we get, but what do you mean innovation coming out of a law school? We said, you know, we're building stuff here, and there are other cool people tinkering around to build stuff. Here, we don't have a New York law school. There's no university overhead. There's no chunk of change that goes to the university, and there's no bureaucracy, and there's nobody saying you can't do this because Rick doesn't say you can't do this. So he says you can do this. So
sounds to me like a fraud organization.
Yeah, the drug ring we're actually going to run. That's how we could fund all the operations, really.
Cali College of Law, or
for some, but
we actually have a program at Columbia.
Oh, that kind of Cali. Yeah, Cali. That's what.
Yeah,
it
no,
really
no, not the
for.
Not the one. Yeah, not
the one.
Not
the one in yeah. Chicago. Yeah. So so what I really want to do is I want us to. Figure out ways of doing more civic innovation, social software building together, and together being all of the cool, fun people that we know, and there are people like Clay Shirky up the street and folks at NYU, and to put in place the structure, which I think we can do better together, for funding innovation coming out of, from legally minded folk. And developing maybe some models to generate revenue to sustain this going forward. I mean, I think there's a model which we've talked about for, I think there are a lot of entrepreneurs and people with money who would love to see some of the innovations that we develop and would help us to, you know, continue to innovate and to do fun things, with the idea being that we would release, we would send this stuff out into the world. It's probably the most coherent way of putting that.
Hey, Jared, it sounds good to me. Some questions. Rick, if you imagine this national law school that you described as somehow an organization that involves sharing from the